If you're visiting with us this morning, we are happy that your choice to come and be with us. We'd like to have you come back if you're able to. If you're from the area, we meet again this evening at 6 o'clock for worship. And then on Wednesday night, we meet at 7 o'clock for Bible studies for all ages. And of course, it's always good to see our own members here. We join together as a family in worship to God. We are engaged in a series of lessons looking deeply into the scene just before the death of Christ. We're looking about a period of time about 18 to 21 hours before he is giving his life on the cross. And the purpose of this is, so often when we look at the cross of Jesus in this section of Scripture, we focus on the immediate, him on the cross, and what took place. What transpired. We look at his scourging and the pain that was caused by that, and the nails that were driven, and the crown of thorns, and the seven sayings that he offered while he was on that cross. And we will get there. But in this study, we are going a little bit deeper into some passages of Scripture that maybe we don't talk about much, and yet are very significant to the events. This morning, we are going to focus on the first set of trials that Jesus endures. And this is in Matthew chapter 26, as well as in John chapter 18. It's the trials of the Jews. There are really two divisions. You had the first set of trials that were Jewish, and as we're going to see, it starts off with Jesus one-on-one before Annas, and then he'll go to Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin, and then eventually, as dawn broke, he would once again go before the Sanhedrin. That comprises the first set of trials. The second set of trials are the Gentile trials, and they go from him before Pilate to him before Herod, and then once again, back to Pilate. But as we look at the Jewish trials, it is important for us to have an understanding of the cultural and the historical background of the Jews and their system of law. The system of justice that God established in Israel. When God gave the law of Moses, it was not only a religious law, but it was a civil law. There were ordinances that dictated how Israel was to worship and when they were to worship. But then because they were a physical nation, God also gave them laws to govern them as a people. This system of justice that God gave them was second to none. It surpassed in many ways Egyptian law and Canaanite law in that it always sought to find the maximum amount of fairness and to always encourage mercy. It wasn't about finding guilt as much as it was about doing and finding truth. That system of law that God gave really is predicated on one passage in the Old Testament. So I invite you to look at Deuteronomy chapter 16. In Deuteronomy chapter 16 and at verse 18, we read this. This is God speaking through Moses to the children of Israel. He says, "You shall appoint judges and officers in all your towns that the Lord your God is giving you according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You shall not pervert justice. You shall not show partiality. And you shall not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and subverts the cause of the righteous. Justice, and only justice, you shall follow, that you may live and inherit the land that the Lord your God is giving you." How amazing that principle is, because that system of justice is one that we find on a secular basis as really being the foundation for our system of justice and the philosophy of law. And that is that you are going to set up people in different towns and different cities that are going to judge. And the way you judge is you're going to judge fairly, you're going to judge righteously, you're not going to take bribes, you're not going to pervert, you are not going to be prejudicial in how you judge. You're not going to be partial. Truth is always the goal, and you're never going to distort truth. The Jews prided themselves on that. They looked at that system of law and said, that is amazing, and they said, this is us. And you see, in our culture, it's the same thing. Our system of law, local, state, federal, judges and courts, in which there is to be no partiality, there is no bribery, that what the matter at hand is to be fair and righteous. I would also submit that that's how it is to be in the church, in judging certain things and actions. How did they apply Deuteronomy 16? Because God says this is how you're to do it, this is what you're to do, but how you're supposed to do it. So indulge me for a few minutes as we go through some of these historical things. In any community that had 120 male Jews, they would establish what was called a Sanhedrin. A Sanhedrin, that word Sanhedrin, basically means a sitting together. And so you had these lesser Sanhedrins, and they would be comprised of about 23 men. Now, if you didn't have 120, there would be other ways in which justice would be sought after. But if you had over 120, then you would have the sitting together councils. And they would make judgments. They would render verdicts when there was a conflict or when there was something that was actually criminal done. And then you had in Jerusalem what would be called the Great Sanhedrin. And the Great Sanhedrin was, if we were to put it in our terms, it was the Supreme Court of Israel. It was the final say. It was the highest authority. So if you had a problem with a lesser judgment, that if you felt it wasn't fair, you could always appeal to the Great Sanhedrin. And that Great Sanhedrin had 71 members. 24 were chief priests. 46 were comprised of scribes, elders, Pharisees, and Sadducees, for a total of 70. And then, to break a tie in their voting, you would have the one, that is the high priest. And he would preside over the whole Great Sanhedrin, the Great Council, for a total of 71. Now, the people on that court were not just anybody. These are the best of the best. These are the best thinkers. These are the ones that have proven themselves as having unique wisdom in lower court levels. And if they have not proven themselves there, then they had apprenticed under a member of the Great Sanhedrin. And they were a pupil, and they studied, and they learned all the ins and outs of that system before they could be appointed or chosen for that place. So again, similar to our court system, where a judge might start on a lesser court and then work his way up to a higher court based on how he has done. These were respectable people. These were people that everyone looked to. Not only were they respectable, great thinkers and the kind of men that you would entrust your life to, the Sanhedrin offered a number of guarantees, a number of Jewish rights, if you would, similar to ours. The Jew had the right to a public trial. Everything was to be out in the open and exposed, nothing behind closed doors. Because being out in the open, the people could scrutinize it and say, hey, this isn't right, or this is acceptable. It would also allow for there to be examination to prevent partiality and bribery, and also to eliminate the possibility of someone being framed and pushed through to execution. The second right they had was a right to self-defense. Like our court system, they would have someone who would defend them. And those people would believe in their innocence. If they didn't believe in their innocence, they would be given someone else to do it. So they would have a defense. And they would be able to call witnesses, present evidence, all in an effort to exonerate themselves. Convictions were by no less than two witnesses. If you didn't have two witnesses, there was no conviction that would be possible. Those witnesses were not just anyone. A witness had to be specific. He had to identify the person and say, "Yeah, I saw so-and-so doing this act." And then he had to give the month and the day in which it was done. It was never, "I think I saw him, and maybe he did something around this period of time." He had to be very specific. There was no hearsay. No generalities allowed. False testimony was something that was discouraged severely. Back in Deuteronomy chapter 19 and verse 16, it says, "If a malicious witness arises to accuse a person of wrongdoing, then both the parties to the dispute shall appear before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who are in the office those days. And the judges will inquire diligently, and if the witness is a false witness and has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him as he meant to do to his brother, so you shall purge the evil from your midst." So think about that. If it's a case where, you know, something minor has happened, and I go and I lie about it, well, then that judgment, instead of being pronounced on the person who committed the crime, is pronounced on me. If it's a capital offense and I'm a false witness, then guess what happens if I'm proven to be a false witness? My life is on the line. So you had witnesses who had to be very specific. You had witnesses who were under the power of Scripture to do to the guilty or do to the one who's innocent whatever the charge is if he was found guilty. And the third thing, if you're a witness in a capital case and the person was found guilty and they were taken out and executed, you know who threw the first stone? You, the witness. You imagine that? See, the way God set that up was to really cause a lot of people to think about what they're doing and the heavy burden that was there. There were restrictions by the teachers of the Jews on capital cases that carried through. In a capital case, there was a full day of fasting in between judgment and the execution of that judgment. So say, you know, there is on Wednesday, a judgment is made. Thursday was a day complete fasting by those on the court. And then Friday, the execution would be carried out. And they would not eat any food. They would not drink anything that would potentially intoxicate them so that they might have all their faculties be able to determine right and wrong. Again, very similar to some things in the church, you know, 1 Timothy chapter 3 and the elders, and not given to wine and so on. After that full day of fasting, the council comes back and they're polled a second time just in case someone changed their mind. But when someone changed their mind, they would never go from, "I thought he was innocent, now I think he's guilty." Couldn't do that. The only way you could go is from guilty to innocent. So if I said someone's innocent on day one, then that's what I say no matter what. If I say he's guilty on day one, then I can go back and change that on day three. Let's say he was found guilty. After the fasting, after the second day of polling, then execution was carried out immediately after Ecclesiastes chapter 8. They would take the guy and take two officers of the court. The one officer would go out in front, and another officer would be behind on a horse. And as they were going out, the first officer would yell out as a herald to everyone what was going on. Who the person was, what they've done, who the witnesses were that brought about the judgment of his guilt. Just in case someone along the line from the court to the place of execution said, I have new evidence. And then the writer in back, this is the one that fascinated me. He's riding along, and as he's riding along, he keeps looking back towards where the court is. Because the court would send out a man with a flag, and if anything came up in the process of going from the court to the place of execution, the man with the flag would wave it, and immediately they would turn around and bring the guilty individual or the individual back and retry his whole case. What's the point of all that? They wanted a fair trial. They didn't want anyone innocent to be put to death. There are other things. The council would only try cases brought by an outside party, never something they brought up on their own. Women, children, slaves, the mentally incompetent and questionable character could never testify. Criminal trials were never to be held at night, always during the day. And if it carried over into the night, they would adjourn till the next morning. And the accused was always presumed innocent. Now I ask you, if you were a Jew living under that system of justice, would you feel pretty comfortable? Pretty safe? If some accusation came up, you feel, hey, you know what? Respectable people, there's good laws and good philosophy put in place. I feel I'm going to get a fair trial. We would. However, in Jesus' trial, the great Sanhedrin violated every single principle. They violated every law. And through that, carried out the greatest injustice of all time. Because they took everything they held dearly to them and threw it out the window. Because they hated Jesus that much. They despised everything about him. Let's look at the text then. In Matthew chapter 26 and at verse 57, after Jesus is arrested and bound, it says, then those who had seized Jesus led him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders had gathered. And we start to see what I call the kangaroo court of the high priest. Matthew's account skips something. It says they immediately take him to the house of Caiaphas where they were assembled, that is, the Sanhedrin Council, and then they try him. John's account presents something that happened in between. And so let's look over at John chapter 18 and at verse 12. John chapter 18 and verse 12 says, so the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. First they led him to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. It was Caiaphas who advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. So Jesus is going to go to the house of Caiaphas, who is a high priest. But before he does that, he goes to Annas. Now, why Annas? In Annas, we see what I call the unjust confrontation. Annas was the power behind the priesthood. He was, if you would, the mob boss, the godfather in Jerusalem. He had his hand in everything, and he was making a profit over and through all these things. And he despised Jesus. He hated Jesus. Why? John chapter 3 and verse 19, we read, and this is a judgment that light has come into the world, and people love the darkness rather than the light because their works are evil. When people like darkness, light hurts. And Annas loved the darkness. And so when Jesus comes into the world and he is the light, he presents a picture that is so contradictory to the life that Annas lived, that Annas hated it. he hated. And he hated Jesus. So his goal was to have Jesus killed, to soothe himself and his conscience and his power over Jerusalem. But who was he? Annas himself had been a high priest. He was a high priest from about AD 7 to about AD 14. So we're looking about 15 years after, 15 to 16 years after he stepped down, after he was pushed out. Rome pushed Annas out of the priesthood because Annas was having too much power. He was gaining too much control, so they push him out. So what happens is, five of his sons and his son-in-law succeed him. Caiaphas is his son-in-law. But even though Caiaphas technically is the high priest, Annas held the title, held the power. That family was corrupt. It was that family who was controlling the temple in John chapter 2 when Jesus cleanses it. And it was that family that was controlling the temple the second time Jesus cleanses it in Matthew chapter 21. Remember, Jesus comes in the temple, and in the temple there's money changers. Well, what was the purpose of the money changer? Money changer, let's put it like this. Currency in that day and time was Roman. Roman currency had the image of Caesar. To a Jew, that was idolatrous. It violated graven image in the Ten Commandments. And so when you went to the Temple Mount to pay your temple tax or to give or to donate, you couldn't do that with Roman money. You had to exchange it for Jewish money. And so you had these money changers there. Oh yeah, sure, I'll exchange your money so you can do your responsibility here at the temple, but I'm going to charge you a certain percentage to do it. Guess where that percentage went? To Annas and the family. Then you had the animal trade. Because if I come from my house to offer a sacrifice, whether it be a bird or a sheep or something like that, and I go and I do this and I carry my animal around, a priest has to examine and say, okay, this animal meets the standards for sacrifice. Wonder how many animals actually met those standards. Because now you have a priesthood who is saying, you buy our pre-certified, ready to offer, and we'll charge you a little bit more for it. So do you want to take that lamb all the way from your house into Jerusalem to potentially sacrifice it only to have it rejected, and you to go ahead and purchase another lamb so you can do that and then take that one all the way back home? No, you're going to buy that lamb for a premium. Where'd that money go? It goes to the pockets of Annas and Caiaphas and the family. When Jesus says, you've taken my father's house and you've turned it into a den of thieves, he was not joking. These people were thieves. They were robbers. And Jesus shine the light right in their face, and they hated it. So they wanted to kill him. He's a threat. Just as the idol makers in Ephesus were threatened by Paul, Annas and Caiaphas are threatened by Jesus. So here's Annas. Now he has Jesus before him. And the one purpose was to find a charge. Look at verse 19. Then the high priest, this would be Annas, then questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. Annas says, I want to know about what you teach. I want to know about your doctrine, and I want to know about your disciples. What do you teach? Who follows you? Well, stop a second. In an arraignment, if you're brought in to a grand jury, and that's what Annas would be in this situation, would be like a grand jury, you don't tell them what you've done, and they don't ask you what you've done. They tell you what they believe. But he's not doing that. What's he doing? He's talking in generalities in order to uncover something that he could try him for, to then punish him for a sentence that he's already decided on, and that's death. And so Jesus responds in verse 20. says, I have spoken openly to the world. I've always taught in the synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews come together. I've said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who've heard me what I said to them. They know what I said. In other words, Jesus says, you know what, Annas? Here's a problem. I've talked out in the open. You should know what you're talking about. And if you have a problem with me, if you have a case against me, if you have witnesses, bring them out here. You don't need to ask me this question. Even though Jesus is determined to go to the cross, he is not going to go there by violating the law. And so what he does, in essence, is he frustrates and embarrasses Annas. He says, you have absolutely nothing. If you did, the witnesses would be here, the trial would be here, the charge would be here, and we'd be going through this, and it's fine. But you have none of that. And so in verse 22, this is remarkable. When he had said these things, one of the officers standing by struck Jesus with the hand, saying, is that how you answer the high priest? See, he was on the side of Annas. He is defending the high priest's honor. And he sees Jesus as that threat. But how does Jesus respond to the slap across the face? He says, if what I said is wrong, bear witness about the wrong. Tell me what I've done. But if what I said is right, why do you strike me? Why do you strike me? And is there an answer? No answer. It's kind of ironic. Jesus reacts differently than the Apostle Paul. Paul found himself in a similar situation where he says something to a priest. This priest was named Ananias in Acts chapter 23. And one of those that was there stood by and struck Paul on the mouth. And I like what Paul says. He says, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. God's going to strike you down for that. Jesus doesn't do that. He says, if I've done anything wrong, tell me what I've done wrong. And then we'll move on. No emotional reaction at all. So what's Annas do? Send him off to Caiaphas. Have Caiaphas figure out what to do. Now we go back to Matthew chapter 26. In Matthew chapter 26, now in the time that Jesus was at the house of Annas, and Caiaphas has gathered the whole Sanhedrin together, and now they have to find out, what are we going to charge Jesus with? Remember, the Supreme Court, the High Court, this great Sanhedrin, never originated charges. It was always from outside. Now they have to originate charges. In Matthew chapter 26, and beginning at verse 59 now through verse 61, it says, the chief priests and the whole council were seeking false testimony against Jesus, that they might put him to death, but they found none, though many false witnesses came forward. At last two came forward and said, this man said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days. Here we uncover the conspiracy. They didn't want truth. How do I know that? Jesus is truth. They want to kill Jesus. So the question is, how do you kill someone who is innocent? The only way you do is lie about it. Trump up some charges against him, and that's exactly what they do. But Jesus is perfect. And perfection never violates anything. So now they're seeking false testimony. Remember, what was the job of the Sanhedrin? It's to find truth. It was about uncovering what is false and wrong, not about creating it. And so they seek people to give false testimony, and many came before them. And in Mark chapter 14 and verse 56, it said they couldn't find two that agreed. I mean, not even close, because the ones that do come forward are close. They still don't agree, but they're close. Everyone else that came forward, I mean, just as far away from truth as you possibly can be. And they knew that there wasn't even any hope through them. You imagine their frustration? How hard is it to get two people to agree on this man doing something? Finally, to come forward. Matthew says, this is that they said this. In verse 61, he says, "This man said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days." What's interesting is Mark presents a different statement. So what happens is Matthew presents the statement of one witness, and Mark presents the statement of the second witness. And in Mark chapter 14, verse 58, he says, "I will destroy the temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another." You notice the differences there? One said, "I am able." Not that I'm going to, but I'm able. I have the power. And the other one said, "I will," and is determined that to do it. So those two witnesses didn't even agree. But here's what's remarkable. Neither one of them quoted Jesus correctly. And sometimes neither do we. In John chapter 2, and beginning at verse 19. John chapter 2. And verse 19, we'll see what Jesus, in fact, says. John chapter 2 and verse 19. Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." Did you get the difference? One says, "I will," or "I'm able to destroy the temple." That's Matthew's account. One said, "I will destroy the temple." That's Mark's account. But what Jesus actually said was, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." Question is, who's going to do the destroying? They both quoted and said Jesus was going to do the destroying. Jesus never said that. Jesus said, "Destroy, you Jews, destroy this temple, my body, and in 3 days I'll raise it up." What Jesus was talking about was exactly what's going on here. The Jews were seeking to destroy Jesus. So you have two witnesses. They don't agree. Now what? Now, you're going to have to wait till next week. So I definitely do not have time to get through this. But something was going to happen here, and it's just going to continue to just frustrate the Jews. And through all of this, I'll just go real quick, don't read them. There we go. You see how innocent Jesus is. You see him blameless. No sin. And you see him resolved. This is where we come in. The trial that Jesus faced is the trial I deserve. The treatment that he receives from the officer of the court that was standing there that slapped him when he spoke out against the high priest and embarrassed him is the slap that I receive. The sentence of death that we'll talk about for speaking out against God is the sentence that I deserve because my life has been in rebellion to God. And yet he took it all for me. He's innocent. I'm guilty. How amazing that is. And yet he does it with such grace and such majesty, such peace, such calm, such resolve. Why? Because that's why he came. He came to pay the price for my sin. To shed his blood so that the wrath of God and the justice of God might be pacified against me, a sinner. That's awesome. But does that mean I just do whatever I want? Hey, Jesus did this, so I go out, do whatever I want, live however I want, act however I want. He did it, and I don't have to do anything. No. We have to be obedient. Faith without works, as we're studying James on Sunday night, is dead. My belief in who Jesus was and in his sacrifice and what the sacrifice accomplishes does me no good if I do not obey him. And so we look at what Jesus asks us to do. Jesus says in Mark chapter 16 and verse 16, he who believes and is baptized shall be saved. He who does not believe shall be condemned. I must believe in who Jesus is, that he is the Son of God coming in the world in the flesh, who lived a perfect sinless life, and then that he died and was sacrificed for my sins and then raised the third day. And then based on that belief and the confidence I have in those things, I'm going to change my life, I'm going to repent, I'm going to confess his name, and I'm going to be, as he says there in Mark chapter 16, baptized. The result of that is my sins are washed away. But that doesn't end it, does it? Because at that point in time, I have to live faithfully. Because I can't go back to living according to the world, because then, now that I am innocent of sin because of Jesus' sacrifice, I can return back to my sin. And Peter says about that in 2 Peter that the end is worse than the beginning. So I have to be committed to following him each and every day of my life, submitting my will to his will. So I ask you the question. If you're here this morning and not yet a child of God, do you believe those things and are you willing to do them? Do you believe who Jesus is, and based on that belief, are you willing to submit your life to Jesus and become a child of God through baptism? If so, why not do something about it today, right now? We stand ready, we stand willing to help you to make your life right with God. We invite you to come forward while we stand and sing this song.